Vishal Norris left NPR after 13 years late last year to pursue the Race Card Project, her award-winning effort to spur conversation about identity 6 words at a time. She's in town today to be the keynote speaker for the 11th annual Women of Color Leadership Conference. This year's theme, Our Time, Voices of Color in a State of Unrest. In 2010, Norris published her first book, The Grace of Silence, a family memoir that dealt with secrets from her own family's past and how America talks about race in the wake of Barack Obama's presidency. Before her time at NPR, Michelle spent almost 10 years as a reporter for ABC News in the Washington Bureau. She's also worked as a staff writer for the Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, and the LA Times. But I think I can speak for our listeners that she is missed. Michelle, welcome to Up to Date. Welcome to Kansas City.
It's great to be here in Kansas City, and especially great to be here with you.
There's that voice again. So good to hear it again. Yeah. When you left NPR, you said this, Michelle, after being in one place for 13 years, I want to take stock of a completely changed media landscape and figure out what I want to do next and where I want to do it. You're obviously very involved in the Race Car Project, as I mentioned, but have you reached any other conclusions?
Well, something I think that any of us who work in journalism and communication understand is that we have to figure out how to reach people in a completely different way. People consume news very differently, and that's scary because, you know, for many people, that timeline that they see in Twitter or Facebook is their primary source of news, and that's scary for all of us. But there are also great opportunities in that you can help spark conversations in ways that are different now, that you can actually bring people together and help moderate conversations about really difficult topics in real time. And that's something that we try to do at the Race Card Project.
Well, are you going to engage in the media in addition to the Race Card Project, or is that your central focus?
We're actually working with several partners to develop different manifestations of the Race Card Project.
Wow.
So, in video, through podcasts. There are some people that are interested in animation, for instance, and the interesting things that you can do through animation to take a story and look at it in lots of different dimensions. So,
you know, this notion of the Race Card Project, that the titles have to be in 6 words.
Yes.
Where did that idea come from, and how well is it working?
Well, it works pretty well in that we have almost 50,000, actually more than 50,000 submissions from people who've taken the bait and submitted 6 words. But I had, at 2 points in my life, I had very important people tell me that if you want to tackle something, you have to break it down to its simplest essence. So when I was in college, I had a professor who said, you make everything so complicated. Just try to, if you can get the sentence, if you can get the thing that you're trying to write, if you can reduce it to one sentence, then you'll have a much easier time building that house that you're trying to build. And later on, when I worked at the Washington Post, I had an editor tell me almost the same thing. And it was manifested there in that the Don Graham, who used to walk the newsroom,
sure. He
wore this blue cardigan sweater. And if you were writing for the front page of the paper, he would lean in and want to see what you were writing, what your lead was, and he'd want to talk to you about the story.
Uh-huh.
You could talk your way off the front page if you were too parenthetical. So you had to figure out, you know, if you were writing about two congressmen that were vying to become the Speaker of the House, you know, you had to figure out how to express that with a real economy of words. So it's a classic Cain and Abel story,
you know? 6 words.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah.
You know, two people who saw themselves as brothers now competing. And so to take on a difficult, thorny, prickly topic like this, it's perfect. And it's perfect in that it allows people to really take something and bring it down to its essence. But then it has this effect, and if you look at the site, you'll see that,
sure.
of almost opening the spigot. You know, once you figure out what your 6 words are, when we ask, is there anything else you'd like to say, they often come back with essays, with letters, with these full descriptions of what they meant, of what, you know, the territory they're trying to mine, the stories that often they haven't shared with anyone else. And they, for some reason, give it to me and say, yes, I want you to post that because I can't be the only person who's going through this.
Yeah, I saw one last night. It's so poignant. Again, the 6-word headline, "He Can't Swim, Dad Saves Him."
Yeah.
Okay, about a black boy who was a great athlete, but almost drowned because he had never learned to swim. The writer, Jim McConsky of Virginia Beach, Virginia, figured out that the boy had never learned to swim because there was no place for him to learn how to swim. He wrote this, "I was introduced to racial discrimination in deeply personal and scary ways." I'm wondering, Do you have a favorite story or two that comes to mind? Because that one really grabbed me.
I'll share a couple with you.
Yeah.
But that I love that story.
I do too.
Because there's so much wrapped up in that. You know, it pools throughout the South, and really not just in the South. Were closed or closed off to people. So there was a generation that never really learned how to swim. This is a major issue. It contributes to drowning rates for African Americans, to basically water safety issues.
We had a star running back for the Kansas City Chiefs back in the early 80s, Joe Delaney, who died from hopping in a pond to save
right.
a kid.
Because, you know, and so it's mm. it's a real issue. It also points to that moment of integration, which was often
yes.
sparked by sports. And, you know, and I know that there are many stories here in Missouri where there were secret games that were held. Basketball players weren't allowed to play on a court, so they secretly played to sort of pave the way. So one of the things I love about the project is that it takes me to places that I wouldn't get to otherwise. So you asked me a few of my favorites.
Yes, sure.
This is one I love, but for reasons that are painful. Early on, six words arrived in the inbox, and I still remember the way I felt when they arrived. The six words were, "Black babies cost less to adopt."
Wow.
Hard to even say that out loud.
Yeah, there you go.
And it was sent by a woman named Michelle Person in Covington, Louisiana. We wound up doing a story about this for Morning Edition when we did the race card segments for mm-hmm. NPR, because we did some research, and we realized that there was truth to that statement. Not that Black babies cost more. You don't buy children when you enter the adoption process, but there's a fee structure attached to it. And in almost every state, the fee structure attached to children of color is much less than for children who are Caucasian.
Really,
the fee structure for children of color who are light-skinned is often less than for those with dark skin. This is such ugly stuff, and it's so difficult to talk about, but I appreciate that this issue came to me. And I was able to actually delve into this a little bit and realize that lots of states are wrestling with this. Lots of adoption agencies are wrestling with this. It's due to, you know, and some of it is explained through altruistic reasons. One of the reasons that the rates are sometimes reduced is because the adoption rates for families of color are much lower. So it's meant to incentivize families
yeah.
to participate in the wonderful process of opening your home and your heart to adoption. But everyone involved in this says that there's something else. That it also is a reflection of our values in society. It's a reflection of market forces, of supply and demand. And you know, and so that's an example of as a journalist, I really appreciated that story.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I love the humor people have. Underneath, we all taste like chicken. You know, that the doctor, you know, sent that in and it was funny. I really appreciate stuff like that.
You know, you once said of the Race Card Project, it touches, and maybe we're illustrating this point as we talk here, it touches people like nothing I've ever done in mm-hmm. journalism. And you've done so much in journalism. The secret of its power, again, is you're offering an avenue for candor that people don't have anywhere else, it sounds like to me.
And it surprises me all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I called it the Race Card Project, and I assumed, frankly, if I'm honest, that most of the people who would pull up to the table and share their stories would be people of color. The majority of the submissions, if you go on the website, you'll see it, are from white Americans.
Huh.
And they're often saying, I could have called the project Glad You Asked, because they're saying, I'm glad that I have a voice and an opportunity to share my story.
And that surprises me, because traditionally, my sense is people of white people tend to hold back because they don't want to say the wrong thing.
That was my expectation
yeah,
also.
Right.
But they're also often not talking about skin color. Some of them are. Some of them are talking about the experience like the one you shared at the swimming pool.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're talking about their ethnicity, their geography, you know, what it's like to have to come from West Virginia or to be Appalachian, and the assumptions that are made about people who come from Appalachia. And they're
mm-hmm.
often, you know, unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about being gay or lesbian. They're talking about how the world sees them differently when they drive the pickup truck in their driveway as opposed to the sports car, and how that helps them understand, boy, if people are judging me based on this, who else is getting judged in society.
Yeah, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on race in general, speaking broadly here, as we reach the end of Obama's presidency. I mean, I guess the question is, we started off thinking we were going to enter a new realm here. I think a lot of people started off thinking we'd be in a new place after 4 or 8 years with a black president. But I'm wondering if we're at that point, or if he has just stirred the pot, you know, given Ferguson and Baltimore and New York and everything else. What do you think?
All that's true,
yeah.
But some of that was perhaps Pollyannish. You know, that whole notion of being post-racial and entering this post-racial space.
I plead guilty.
You know, and I don't mean to say I told you so. You know, I'm not going to say that. But at that moment, I thought, what are we talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Think about the country that we live in. You know, within my lifetime, men of color were not allowed to hold any kind of position of authority in America at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm not that old. I'm just going to say. It's radio. People can't tell that, so I'll just say that, you know, for the record. But within the short time that I've been on this earth, we've seen great changes. So we were going to assume that a man of color, a family of color, was going to move into the White House in a country where most people have never had a black boss, and that it was all going to be over. You know, I think it helped us maybe feel better about that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because it really was an amazing moment.
Absolutely.
But instead of rolling up our sleeves and preparing for perhaps one of the hardest chapters in terms of reconciliation and reckoning, we instead sort of sat back and maybe suggested that it was over, when instead we were entering a chapter that was going to be fairly complicated. And not just because of the fact of the presidency, but because there are all these other factors that are part of the stew, the changing demographics of the nation,
yes.
the economic tumult that we're still experiencing. The numbers say that we've recovered, the jobs reports, the labor reports, but a lot of people don't feel the recovery. And just the sense of fear that people have because of threats from afar, because of threats closer to home. So all that has contributed to a very fragile environment and climate around race and ethnicity and identity in America. And did he stir the pot? You know, in part because of his ambitions and the fact of his presidency. But the reality is that some of this was going to be at or below the surface, no matter who sat in that office. And we should remember that for the next president and for the next leader and for the next CEO and the next college president and the next, you know, wherever that leadership happens to be, that they're inheriting an environment that may be fraught with race, even if it's not fraught with race, that elements of race will be part of whatever they inherit, even if you don't necessarily see it.
If you recognize that voice, you're not mistaken. That's Michelle Norris. She's in town to give a keynote address to the 11th Annual Women of Color Leadership Conference. She, of course, a longtime anchor for All Things Considered. I bet the interview you would like to have, I'm guessing, would be to interview President Obama just about what we're talking about here.
Oh, I'd love to interview him. I'm not going to lie. You know,
yeah.
Like that. And I'd like to talk to him about
simple stuff. You've got connections. Yeah.
You know, what I'd love to hear from him, to be honest.
Yeah.
There are only 44 people who've had that perch, and they see America from a very different perch than the rest of us. And I think that they learn things about the country. They learn, they see the places where we're strong at our weakest points and weak in our strongest points. They see the way that people in power, but people without any kind of power, respond to things. And it would be really interesting to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm wondering, as we reflect on President Obama and his 8 years in office, I mean, he has been criticized for not talking more about race, and yet he has at times, and very poignantly so. What do you make of that?
You know, I've always thought that criticism was interesting and a little bit off base.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of it was the expectation that perhaps someone was going to occupy the White House and lead the country in a national conversation,
mm-hmm.
that there would be someone at the head of the table and that we'd all come together and have this conversation.
And he said absolutely not to that very clearly.
Well, I think there may be some merit to that, and that those kinds of conversations perhaps aren't necessarily productive.
Mm-hmm.
But as to the dialogue that he's actually shepherded around race, I think we saw it early on. It just was in very subtle ways. So, you know, one of his first press conferences, he described himself as a mutt, you know, and said, have all kinds of, you know, I have racial heritage that reaches in all kinds of directions. And it was just an offhand comment and was barely reported. And I remember sitting in my office at NPR watching, you know, the relay of that on, I would keep a television on, and I saw that and I thought, well, we've never heard a president use that kind of language before. Mm. The first lady very early on went to Capitol Hill and had children in the White House and just noted in a very casual manner that this house was built by slaves. A fact that, if, you know, people know that, historians have been telling that, but that had never been said in the East Room of the White House. Yeah. So there were moments where he was talking about race in very subtle ways that were dismissed in some way because people were expecting him to stand at a lectern and perhaps talk about race in the way he did in response to the Trayvon Martin case or in the way that he did in Philadelphia, when, in fact, he's probably talked more about race, discussed racial issues much more in public and certainly probably in private than most people understand. And I think some of that speaks to how we as a society deal with race in that in some cases we want to be helped through that conversation. So but it's a little bit like losing weight. You know, you can you can have people counsel you on that and you can have them tell you how to do it and you can have someone lead the conversation. But at some point, if you want to move the numbers, if you want to see results, you have to engage in that process yourself. You have to think about what you're going to eat or how you're going to work out or how often you're going to work out. And I think in issues of race, and I keep saying race and identity because it's not always just about race. It's about class. It's about, you know, all kinds of other issues.
Right.
That you have to put a little skin in the game in order to, you know, to really be fully engaged in that. You can't wait for someone else to lead you through that.
I was going to say a couple of times here you suggested there's hard work to be done. And perhaps I guess I'm hearing maybe we're resisting a little bit, really getting down into the weeds and dealing with some of those things that you hope the Race Card Project begins to get us to.
You know, it is often hard, but it's also rewarding, you know, because and it depends on what your motivation is for doing it. You know, I'm not doing this because I'm trying to solve America's racial dilemma. You know, that's I will tell people this is not a panacea. This is not going to erase anything. In fact, if you spend any amount of time in the Race Card Project and it sounds like you've combed through it, you will be made uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
You will see things
that's
that
right.
will make you squirm. Or, you know, maybe even offend you, probably offend you. The point is to enlighten you, to help you understand that in a country that is this big and as this complex and as this many people sharing a small patch of land, that there's some benefit in understanding life as lived by someone else.
Yeah, yeah.
And even if that doesn't directly, even if they're not your neighbor or directly your coworker, you will be affected by them in some way. And so it's about education and enlightenment and sort of understanding all the various ways that you can be American, that you can travel through America.
You know, when you were mentioning a few minutes ago, Michelle, these moments the president has had, the first thing that flashed into my mind was in the Oval Office one day when the young black boy came in and had the president bend over so that he could touch the president's hair and wanted to know if it was just like his. That just buckled my knees. Yeah. What an amazing moment that was.
And they keep that picture somewhere. You know, you go to the White House, there are pictures that are displayed all over the walls.
And that's one of them.
And they're rotated quite often. So they often have, you know, the most recent trip. So right now there probably will be pictures up from the president's most recent trip to Asia. But that picture is almost always in rotation, I think, because of what it represents. But you know what's interesting about this presidency is that you had someone who was bringing a new narrative to the Oval Office on lots of different fronts, not just because he's a man of color who has, you know,
of course,
curly hair or, you know, an afro. He's someone who was raised by a single mom. He's someone who lived overseas. He's someone who talks openly about living on food stamps at some point with a family that, you know, sat down at the kitchen table and struggled with a budget. That's something a lot of people can relate to.
Yes.
And it's always been interesting to me that all of those other elements of his narrative have have not. He was an urban president. That's not part of the you know, presidents come usually from, you know, white picket fence backgrounds.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so he brought a new perspective to the White House on several fronts. And I remember thinking about this. I was in elementary school, and there was a picture of him as a young boy up on the wall. And I saw a custodian looking at that picture. And it struck me that, you know, the men with the keys in the building, the people who take care, you know, who are there early to open it up, who stay until the end of the last basketball game, you know, so they can close up the building, who really are true custodians of a school environment, that they would look at that president, whether they were black, whether they were white, whether they were Latino, whether they were Asian, and see something of a narrative that would speak to them because of the path that he followed.
Yeah. That's Michelle Norris, her latest project, The Race Card Project. And again, boy, we miss you on NPR's All Things Considered. And what a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
You do great interviews, and you are a great interview. Just made it so easy. Thanks so much for coming in.
Let's do it again.